Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Jizo An Zen Community's Dharma Talks. We are happy to make these recordings available to you. Please consider making a one-time or recurring donation via the link on our webpage found under Become a Member. We thank you wholeheartedly. Gassho.
I wrote this topic tonight because for me, I think the poetic nature of Zen was such a huge draw for me. For years before I entered into Buddhism, I was looking at spiritual stuff and trying to live somewhat of a spiritual life, and I was never really introduced to any of the Eastern, so it was all of the Western. And I always had such a hard time with the Western religious language. It always just made me feel so guilty. And when I was introduced to Zen, I just found this beauty in the way that so much of it was written. And even as you dive deeper into some of the religious teachings in Buddhism and the other Eastern arts, some of it gets very it can get very heavy as well. But there's still this strange mystery to all of it. So I was very drawn to that poetic nature of Zen and the Eastern arts. So I started writing a lot of poetry at that time, and just really fell in love with it. I had done it in most of my life, but not to any real serious degree. So that's kind of how I picked this topic tonight. And through that strangeness of the poetic nature, it offered more inquiry than it did answers, you know? It always made me contemplate more than it said, do this or do that, you know? Which always gave me this sense of curiosity behind it. So even still today, I'm very drawn to that aspect of the Eastern arts, because it, to me, this is the whole practice of what we're trying to do. Osho said it in such a beautiful way. He said, life is not a problem to be solved. It is a mystery to be lived. And I think that's what so much of the teachings for me always offered me. They offered me more of a mystery than they did this hell and brimstone kind of idea. So I wrote a little poem. The silhouette, light drenched from sacred glass, fools the onlooker by a trick of inspirado. So stoic, so sublime. Don't worry, the criminal is still alive. The truth is stolen away by pious dreams of the light. There's an endless dance of here and gone that each of us must play out in the dream state called I. So subtle, so sublime. Don't worry, the truth is still alive. They say that love is the answer, but nobody bleeds for the dancer. Love is the song that is snuffed out by the whispers and sighs of the half-bloods. By half-blood, I mean, of course, I go right, it moves left. Stop chasing. Stop paying for the master's game. It has always been nothing more than the jester's court. So this poem was actually written from an experience I had. I was leading a men's spiritual retreat at a Catholic church. And each morning I would offer a meditation just like we do. And the place that I chose to sit this first morning was in front of this huge stained glass, beautiful stained glass. And it just was a nice place to sit. I had no idea of anything else of it. So as I sit and all these men started coming in the morning for morning meditation, The sun was rising right behind this stained glass. And I couldn't really tell because I was sitting in front of it. But as I heard later in the day, everybody was like, we walked in and there was like this crazy light coming from behind you, you know, and they're building all these like these stories about like how powerful it was to see that, you know. And I was like, oh, I just sat in front of the stained glass. So the way that we perceive life is so powerful. Even something like that. Oh my God, there was this light emanating from, it wasn't light emanating from me at all. It was just sitting on the up on the altar, you know. But for somebody else that experiences this, it can be very powerful. That's the first line there. The silhouette, light drenched from sacred glass, fools the onlooker by a trick of inspirado. The inspiration sometimes grabs us, you know. Sometimes inspiration can be amazing. It can also be a trick, that's for sure. It can trap us in these moments of feeling good, you know. So, and I love this aspect of what Buddhism offers us is it offers this really deep, this really rich way of seeing reality. And part of that reality is seeing my abstractions, seeing my afflictions, because that blocks me from reality. Literally blocks me from reality. And so all the poetry and all of the crazy little things that we find in the teachings are here for us to awaken this blockage, you know. If I don't awaken it here, I will never find it here. You know, I'll never see the sacredness. And when we say noble silence or sacred silence in a room, the ego goes, what the heck is that for? You know, but the minute you tap into that sacred silence, the minute you taste that noble silence, it has something really, really real to it, you know. I heard a teacher say one time, Zen is the greatest hoax of all time. Zen is the greatest hoax of all time. And in some ways, I really appreciate that because in some ways, Zen tricked me into facing reality. That's all it did. It tricked me. Oh, if I put on these robes, oh my God, my life will be so much better. What a nonsense that was. Although, don't get me wrong, I love my life, you know. And to wear these robes is a great honor, but it's a partial curse as well, you know. A movie is composed of millions, if not billions, of brief images, so-called individual pictures, frame after frame after frame. If you remove one photo to describe the movie, it would be so incomplete that explaining the movie from that one frame would be impossible. Our life is exactly the same way, composed by thousands, if not millions, of small stories. We create an identity of the me based on all of these so-called personal experiences. This is who I am, and here's the stories to prove it. Yet in reality, all of our reality, all of yet in reality, all of our experiences are interpersonal. They are not individual at all. It's impossible. And yet the ego crawls so deeply in on itself that it feels as a separate self. It feels and experiences life as a separate entity. But I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, all of us had either a mother or somebody that raised us as an infant, because none of us would be here if that wasn't the case. Somebody took care of us, somebody fed us, somebody cleaned us, somebody kept us warm. And when I really look back over my life, that's been happening from the time I was in the womb. Something or somebody was taking care of me. All of my experiences in life were also related to another, or to a situation, or to a group. Even the terrible ones, even the ones that I beat myself up for my own personal mess ups, it was still based off of somebody else. So all of my experiences in life, are interwoven with others. Have you ever asked yourself if the story of you is actually true? Would you know it? Would you know if your whole life was some sort of smokescreen, a sort of diversion to keep you from seeing reality? These were some of the things that started to awaken for me as I started this practice. I started looking back over my life and started to see all of this subtle and sometimes profound things that I added to the stories in my life. The infatuations, the removing of certain parts to make it sound better, the adding of certain parts to make it sound better. Also subtle, you know? I always say I never told like big Paul Bunyan tales that were so like outlandish and false. But I always added little bits to my story, or I took little bits apart, you know? And so from that place, I realized that the stories that I carried about myself were, they were somewhat false, you know? A sort of diversion to keep me from seeing reality. And to see oneself, Carl Jung said, for somebody to accept themselves is the most horrifying thing. He said something like this, because I have to see all of myself. I have to see all the creepy, icky stuff too, you know? And nobody likes to admit that stuff. Oh. One of my favorite writers wrote this little quote. People don't want their lives fixed. Nobody wants their problems solved, their dramas, their distractions, their stories, their messes cleaned up. Because what would they have left? Just the big, scary unknown. Just the big, scary unknown. So this is what happens when we start to strip away this ego self, this identity. You know, when you really strip away this identity, what's left? Just this raw creature called human, you know, with all its neurosis, with all its weird stuff, with all its loves, all of its fears, all these things are left over, you know? And I think in some ways, I know in some ways, when you accept that for exactly what it is, then there's this strange freedom that arises from it. It's like this is the strangeness of paradox. It is paradoxical that when you surrender, you win, you know. To die is to awaken, you know. Ram Dass said dying is like taking off a tight pair of shoes. I love that. And I can do that while I'm alive. Because I don't know about you, but this ego state that we carry is so tight. It's so gnawing and annoying because everybody annoys me. From my ego state, everything and everyone annoys me. But when that starts to fade away, when we start to drop this ego state, it's like, oh, thank God, I don't have to worry about everybody. I don't have to fix everybody. I can just live in this crazy existence, you know? The interesting part is how strong the ego state is. This me, the I, is so strong. I think that's the thing that I see more and more as I stay. Roshi used to say this all the time. He would talk about this, and he would say, the longer you practice, the more difficult it gets. And man, it's so true. Because you, at least for myself, I thought I would get to a place where the ego would just go away, you know? And he would just stop messing with me. It hasn't happened yet. He's a little Schmeagle that I think I'll always carry, you know. Always looking for the precious, you know. Strangely enough, when things crumble apart, the opposite actually arises. The collapse reveals something that was unseeable prior to the earth giving way. So for us humans, when the ego states start to collapse or crumble apart, it leaves us with the question, who am I? What is this? What is this experience? What is this human life, you know? Shakyamuni was driven by this question from the time he was a small boy. His was in the form of what is suffering? There's a beautiful book called Old Path, White Clouds, that Thich Nhat Hanh wrote. And it's basically a story of the Buddha's life from the time he was born and as he had went through all of these disciplines and all of these practices. And at least historically, it was said that that thing was born within him in a from a very early age. This desire to find out what this reality was, because he saw this great split between reality and the me, the I. And in that I is the suffering. In reality is the freedom. But it took him so long to find this, you know. The thing that I love is his dedication and his commitment was immovable. There was nothing could stop him, nothing stop him in it. His practice was so radical because it went against everything that was taught, both secularly and religiously. He was not trying to be rebellious. He eventually saw that every concept and belief was actually a hindrance to direct experience. Every concept and belief is a hindrance to actually tasting life, actually experiencing things directly. I was talking on our Sunday morning meditation, and I said, most of us live in two states. We live in the stories or in the fantasies. And both of those keep us away from directly experiencing life. It's the same thing. Those are the hindrances. Maybe Shakyamuni's surrender was so gentle. Maybe it was not. Maybe it was not. But his desire to know the truth awoke for him this one-pointed mind. Just sit, just watch, just be. And he saw. The great challenge is for each of us to see in our own direct experience, not by others' words or beliefs. And so we come together in places like this and we sit by ourselves. We sit alone. It's amazing. No matter how many people are here, you are still stuck within this one human form. It's already connected, but until we see that and we directly experience that, I still sit alone. Ryokan wrote this beautiful poem. Yes, I'm truly a fool, living among trees and plants. Please don't question me about illusion and enlightenment. This old fellow just likes to smile to himself. I wade across streams with bony legs and carry a bag in the fine spring weather. That's my life, and the world owes me nothing. And the world owes me nothing. The name that was given to him is really beautiful, Ryokan Taigu, and it means broad-hearted, generous fool. Broad-hearted, generous fool. And so once again, this reality always comes back to the Buddha's statement. You are already Buddha. You are already it. You are already everything. And our teacher would always say, now live accordingly to that. That's the great challenge, you know? It is so wild. And I think that's the part of it that I still love so much, that it is wild. It's like being in nature. Nature is so wild. So if you see your life as a part of this natural experience, this nature arising, which we are just trunks and branches and leaves and roots, fungus. We're all of it. We're all the stuff, you know? If you can learn to be with that as it's arising, then when these mental formations that come, they won't drag us back into the bottom of the ocean, you know? They won't tear us limb to limb. You can just see the mental formation as just a mental formation. You can see the hindrance as just a hindrance, no big deal. Until then, it will tear us apart a bit, you know? And that's where the Buddha said, no mud, no lotus. Yeah. Without suffering, then there would be no cause for awakening. There would be no striving to see this reality, this direct experience, you know? And I just wanted to end with this probably one of my all-time favorite Zen poems. There is a reality even prior to heaven and earth. Indeed, it has no form, much less a name. Eyes fail to see it. It has no voice for ears to detect. To call it mind or Buddha violates its nature, for it then becomes like a visionary flower in the air. It is not mind nor Buddha, absolutely quiet, and yet illuminating in a mysterious way. It allows itself to be perceived only by the clear-eyed. It is Dharma truly beyond form and sound. It is Tao having nothing to do with words. Wishing to entice the blind, the Buddha has playfully let words escape his golden mouth. Heaven and earth are ever since filled with entangling briars. Oh, my good, worthy friends gathered here, if you desire to listen to the thunderous voice of the Dharma, exhaust your words, empty your thoughts, for then you may come to recognize this one essence.